Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. It's really great to be out here. I want to thank Colleen, Stephanie, Tom, anybody that had anything to do with asking me tonight. It's always a great honor to speak at these things. Somewhere on or around December 28th, 1989, the grace of God separated me from alcohol. It was one of those periods of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that so many of us get to with our drinking. And the clouds of delusion parted just enough for me to see that I can't go on like this. And I detoxed myself and staggered off to an AA meeting. And the things that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous have enabled me to participate in the maintenance of my spiritual condition so that God can keep me safe and protected from the first drink. I'm very, very grateful for that. I want to start at the beginning because from what I've learned about alcoholism, I could see it in myself at a very young age. I'm 5 years old or so, and my mother comes up to me and she says, "You're starting kindergarten today. Get ready." Okay, so I remember not really understanding too much about this, but getting in the car, she drives me across town, opens up the door and says, "There it is, I'll see you later," and drives away. Now, I'm standing up on the hill looking down at this kindergarten class, and it hasn't started yet, but there's kids outside playing tag and playing kickball. They're already friends. They've already integrated. I'm standing up there on the hill thinking, "Oh, my God, I can't do this. I am never going to be able to pull this off. You know, what if they don't like me? What if I say something stupid? You know, what if I look bad? All right?" And all of a sudden I was overcome with self-centered fear of people, fear of, you know, being able to go down there. And for the first time that I can remember, I made the decision to act as if everything was okay and just go and do what I needed to do. But inside I was I was as tense and anxious as you could possibly be. So, the one thing that really would have helped that day was a pint of vodka. You know what I mean? It would have taken away that fear of people and that insecurity and that worrying about what other people would think about me. I would have been the kindergarten kid. You know what I mean? I would have integrated with the peers. I would have done real well. It would have even helped at nap time, probably. Never could deal with that. But anyway, the problem was they weren't serving five-year-olds at that time. That was the problem. The drinking age was 21. So I didn't get any alcohol. I had to go through probably the first 8 years of school with that feeling, that dread, that anxiety about just not feeling comfortable with myself, not feeling comfortable in the environment that I'm in. And it really played me, but it wasn't something that I could ever share with anybody. You know, like if somebody comes up and says, "Hey, Chris, how you doing?" "Okay, great." I could never say, "Well, I'm suffering from feelings of impending doom and I'm terrified of what everybody thinks of me. And, you know, I'm scared to go to class and, you know, I'm worried about..." You know, how are you doing? I mean, you just didn't say that kind of stuff. So I would say the alcoholic, "Fine, you know, I'm doing okay." And I went through, I don't know, I got to eighth grade this way, and everything was pretty much a struggle. And then one day, a couple of my buddies and I decided to cut school and go back to my mother's house because she was working and get drunk. We were going to buy take a bottle of whiskey or something and drink it. And I remember taking the whiskey down. You know, nobody was a hard drinker, a hard liquor drinker in my family. You know, I had to dust this thing off. But I bring it down. I don't know anything about drinking at this time. The only thing I know about is the old John Wayne movies. Remember the John Wayne movies where he'd bust through the saloon door, he'd go up and he'd go, "Bartender, whiskey." And the bartender would take a big bottle of whiskey out, pour a big water glass full, and John would drink the whole water glass down, grab the bottle, and go back to and sit down at the table until he had to shoot somebody. So that's like all I knew about drinking. And So I pour out these big, huge water glasses of Four Roses whiskey. I mean, mentioning that today, I still kind of get that nauseous feeling. Because here's what happened. Now, the two guys that I was with never became alcoholic. They never became problem drinkers at all, as far as I know. Here's what they did. They had about two-thirds of their glass of Four Roses whiskey. And they said, that's good, I'm fine. And they sat back and they watched the show. Because what happened was, I drank my glass, I drank the rest of their glass, and I drank the rest of the bottle. And I went into what is known in alcoholism as a blackout. Any blackout drinkers in here? That's disconcerting, isn't it? You know, you wake up the next day in Topeka with one shoe, you know, or something like, and you don't want to look bad, so you got to pretend you always go to Topeka, you know. It's a nightmare. Well, anyway, I blacked out. And I trashed the house, you know, and I woke up in a field not knowing how I got there. And then I started to get sick, you know, that first drunken sickness. I mean, I had to stay horizontal for 2 days. I was so sick. Now, if anything would have made me sick like that, like if any food or if anything would have ever made me sick like that, I would have stayed away from it no problem. You know, and if it was a rutabaga that made me that sick, you know, I would have had an adequate mental defense to stay away from that rutabaga for the rest of my life. I wouldn't have to go to Rutabaga Anonymous and get phone numbers from other people trying to stay away from rutabagas. You know, it would have been no problem. But here's the issue. Here's the issue. You know that scared kindergartner? You know that self-centered fear and always worrying about what... When I started drinking that alcohol, it disappeared. It was the potion that I was looking for, from freedom from self. And it worked until I started projectile vomiting, you know? But as time went by, as weeks went by, I started to forget how sick I was. But I always remembered what that alcohol did for me. It changed my perspective. It offered me comfort, you know, going about the things that I had a lot of anxiety and fear about. And so I started to drink. And I didn't become a daily drinker right away, but I knew that I'd have to stay away from Four Roses whiskey. But I started to get the Boone's Farm wine or the beer, and I started to plan where I was going to drink, who I was going to drink with, who was going to buy it, because I was only like 14. And I started to manage my life around the use of alcohol. Now, I didn't notice it at that time. Now, I come from a really smart family. My brother and sister are both PhD college professors. My parents were Phi Beta Kappa educators. I mean, they're just incredibly, incredibly knowledgeable in every area that you can imagine. And I'm doing okay in school, but all of a sudden, around 14 years old, I start failing everything. And I didn't see it at the time. Like, you know, I didn't say to myself, boy, since I've become preoccupied with alcohol, my grades have slipped. If I go on like this, I might not get into the college of my choice. You know, I didn't say that. You know what the alcoholic says? Who cares? Leave me alone. Get off my back. It's none of your business, you know? And that was my war cry as I sabotaged my life from, say, 14 on. Now, alcohol worked pretty well for me in the early days. Now, I could never control my drinking from day one, but I'd try to manage it. If I drank beer, I could last 3 or 4 hours without going into a blackout. And, you know, I started this management of my alcohol, but I always knew I drank differently than the people I drank with. I was always way drunker than they were for some reason. And, you know, like I'd go out later on in life, I'd go out drinking with some of these people, and they'd say, well, you know, it's almost 11 o'clock. Got to get home. I'm going to work tomorrow. I'd be like, what? Are you crazy? You know, let's go to the city. You know, they got after hours clubs. You know, it's Chris, it's Tuesday. You know, like, come on. And, You know, so I always knew that I drank a little bit differently than some of these other people. Now, I get through high school. One of the things I did in high school was I took Wednesdays off, just to break up the week. You know, 2 days and 2 days looks a lot better than 5 days. So the teachers would go, "Where's Chris today?" And somebody would go, "It's Wednesday." And the teachers would go, "That's right, it's his day off." And so out of a really smart family, I graduated second stupidest in my graduating class, you know. And I really had to work for that D-minus or whatever it was. Anyway, I get out of high school and, you know, remember the high school parties? They were great, weren't they? Everybody's drinking, and there's dancing and rock music, and there'll be a fist fight, and somebody will crash a car, you know, and you'll be inappropriate with the women, and they'll be okay with it, you know. I mean, remember all that time? I mean, I lived for those parties, because being out of control wasn't such a big deal at those things. Now, I get out of high school, and the people that graduated with me, they're getting jobs, or they're going to college. Some of them are, you know, marrying and starting families. And I'm still looking for that high school party. And it just got worse and worse as time went on, you know, because it wasn't there. Finally, a buddy of mine comes back from college. This is like 3 years into my trying to figure out what I'm going to be when I grow up. And he comes back and he goes, "Yeah, I'm down in college." I go, "How is it?" He goes, "Man, it's the best college in the world. There's a bar in every campus building, and all the drugs in the country come through this place." So I go, "Where do you sign up?" You know, could have been a nursing college or something, for all I know. I sign up, and I'm on my way down to the University of South Florida, like the next day. And oh, man, what a place. That was brutal. That was, you know, the things that happened in Florida were just insane. Alcoholism is a progressive illness. Over any considerable period of time, if you're alcoholic, it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. And every year, I was paying more and more prices for my drinking. You know, when I was in high school, I got killed in an auto accident. I drove through a telephone pole. And my heart had stopped. I wasn't breathing. They had to CPR me. And then I went flatline again in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. And, you know, they had to paddle me, you know, clear, you know, bring me back. And I get to the hospital. Now, you know, one of the things inherent in the illness alcoholism is an inability to accurately appraise the situation yourself. If you're in here and you're under a year, or you haven't gone through the steps, you're in way more trouble than you think you are. I mean, ask anybody that's been around for a while. You are in way more trouble. You are minimizing like a sumbitch, okay? Now, you know, you have no idea how bad it is. I'm absolutely serious. Anyway, I come to in the hospital, and, you know, I get out of the hospital. The first thing I do is I drive to the liquor store to get booze so that I can drive down to the park and drink it. So I'm drinking and driving again after I just killed myself like 4 days before, not even thinking about, you know, drinking and driving. It wasn't even a debate that happened in my head, you know. Like, we're the type of people where I get my third DWI. I don't say I've got to stop drinking. I say I got to stop driving. You know, it's not a debate. So anyway, I'm crashing cars all over the place. This one time, I go flying into a tree, and took the whole front end off of the car. And there's like, you know, one, like a good neighbor, a good Samaritan is following me, so he stops and, you know, he pulls over. "Are you okay?" And I'm trying to back this thing out with like no front end. I'm trying to back it. He's like, "What are you doing?" And I stagger out of the car. And I go, "I gotta get rid of this vodka bottle." And, you know, I throw it in the woods. He's like, "Look at me." And I start hitchhiking down the street on the wrong side, going the wrong way, you know. So he calls the cops, and I'm like, you know, hitchhiking down the road. The cops pull me over. throw me up against the car, handcuff me, throw me in the back of the car, and I'm riding to the police station. This is going to be a DUI. And I look, and I can read the cop's name, and I go, "You're Officer Kierstead." And he goes, "Yes." I go, "You're the guy that saved my life when I went through the telephone pole over on Lake Road." And so, you know, we're talking. He drives me to my house. We're hugging, you know. He lets me go. You know. Oh, man. One time I'm down in Florida, and I allowed myself to be overserved, as we do every once in a while. And I was so drunk. I'm driving a 1962 Buick LeSabre. I don't know about you guys, but I bought like the $100 cars. And you know, I'd always get a resentment when I'd smash into somebody like with like a late model BMW. I'm like, "What'd you buy that for? You know how much trouble that's going to be with all the insurance and everything? I'm just going to throw mine away and buy another one." You know? What are you thinking? You know? Anyway, I drive up onto this lawn, and it's one of those guys who like cares about his lawn, you know. He's like clips the weeds and, you know, trims the bushes and everything. And I drive up on his lawn, and I take one of his palmetto trees down. It's like a 15-foot high tree, and I take it down with the 62 Buick, and it gets stuck under the car, and I leave his front yard with his tree under my car. He's not happy at all about this, because he's one of those guys that cares about the yard. So he calls the cops about 20 blocks down the road. I'm like sleeping in the car off the side of the road, and the tree's still underneath it, you know? So I come, now I don't remember any of this. This was all pieced together later, because you got to understand, I'm a blackout trigger. But I wake up in jail going, "What?" I had no idea why I was there, and I learned something very important. Don't wake your bunkmate up and ask him. He's usually unconcerned. You know? "What am I doing here?" But I find out later what happened. And you know, I mean, this went on and on and on. I could tell you car crash stories on that. I started to pay a really high price for alcoholism, and I started to put more of my life in the basket for drinking. And the crazy thing about alcoholism is it doesn't allow you the dignity of understanding your true situation. It talks about in the big book, but that you know, we don't know the truth from the false, that we see our life as the only life possible for us, when that's really a delusion. And I allowed myself to just go down and down and down and down. And what do you really do when I had cops after me? I wasn't paying tickets. There was warrants out for my arrest. I owed hospitals. I couldn't pay my rent. I was always unemployable. What do you do when something like that happens? You start to wonder if mom needs some help around the house. This is what you do. So I moved back up to New Jersey, you know, and trying to find the high school parties like 10 years later is really a dark thing, guys, if you ever try that. But anyway, I'm back up in New Jersey, and I'm a heavy-duty hard liquor drinker by this time. And somewhere along the line, I became an electrician. I came to in sobriety, and I was doing electrical work, you know. I have no idea. And, you know, some of the houses that I wired are still up, too, which is... And I did things like, you know, one time I was... You have to drill down into the wall to get an outlet, and I drilled down, and I pulled the end of the drill bit back up, and it looked like it had cloth on it. You know, so I had to go to the homeowner, and I said, "Look, we got to look around upstairs." And he opens up his closet, and there's like 40 suits, all covered with plaster, and one of them's coiled up into the ceiling where I caught it with the drill bit, you know. Oh, man. Another time, I'm wiring this guy's house. Now I'm working with a partner now, you know, who he, you know, the boss put him in charge of me, And he thinks I'm lame, you know, because I'm my eyes are yellow and I'm always shaking in the morning and just reeking of vodka and I can't remember anything. If you tell me three things, I'll ask you a minute later what the hell you asked me. And this one time we're wiring in an electrical panel on this guy's house, and I'm outside at the meter, and you know the guy that I'm working with is right there, and you know how you get dehydrated after you drank a lot of hard liquor? You got like half a gallon of liquid in the morning just to get the engine fired back up. Well, on the way into work, I'd bought a half a gallon of grape drink, and that's what I drank that morning. Now, all of a sudden, I'm like, you know, and I've got experience with this. I know that I have about 8.3 seconds, you know. And I don't want my guy to see me get sick. He already thinks I'm lame, you know. So I know I'll tear around the back of the house, you know, where nobody can see me. So I run around, and I just make it around the back of the house. And I like stucco the back of this house with purple vomit, right? Now, just like a fire hydrant type of a thing. And I thought I was alone. Now, I look over, and about 20 feet away is a deck with a family. It's a mother, a father, and three kids having iced tea. And I could tell they were all related because they all looked like this. You know? Mommy, mommy, the purple puke monster from hell, mommy, save me. You know, now, you don't want to look stupid. You know how we are. So I've got the hose out. Just one time, one terrible thing after another. Another time, you know, I wired in a kitchen addition for this customer. Rewiring this whole kit. I got the whole thing done, and I put all the wires into the wrong panel. I put it into the hot water timer meter panel. So I leave now, everything's fine, right? Well, the whole kitchen goes off at 8 in the morning and comes back on at 8 at night. You know, it's on a timer, the whole kitchen. So they call me up and they go, this is unacceptable. We eat at 6 every night, you know. So I was like a terrible electrician. Now, you know, we all have these moments where, you know, they're jumping off points, or you can call them a bottom. And basically what it is it's a point where you wish to go no further down the scale. And you, if you're lucky, sometimes you become willing enough to do something that will help to change that. And this happened one day. One day, you know, I mean, it wasn't any real special day. My average day was like this. I would come to in the morning in the clothes that I was wearing the night before. I'd go into the bathroom. I'd try to brush my teeth. I'd run out to the car. I'd drive to work. Now, if you would have pulled me over and given me a breathalyzer at 7:30 in the morning, I would have blown a 4.8. And I hadn't had a drink since like 7 o'clock the night before. That's how much of this booze it was just coming out of me. I was just drinking so much. Now, I would get to work, and I would be swearing I was never going to drink again. You know that feeling? This is hard. I can't feel like this. Today's the day I'm never, ever going to drink again. Today's the day. And if you wired me up to a lie detector, it would have been saying I'm telling the truth. But what happened is I'd get the half a gallon of grape drink down. Somebody would go out to get sandwiches. I'd get maybe half a sandwich down and two potato chips. And somewhere around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd start to feel a little better. And I would say to myself, you know that decision that you made this morning on never drinking again? That's a pretty serious decision. You know, we might have to modify that policy a little bit. As a matter of fact, you know, I think it would be a good idea for me to stop on the way home and buy a fifth of vodka. I won't get a quart. I'll just get a fifth. And I would, if you were in the way, if you were doing 32 and a 35 in between me and the liquor store after work, you're in danger. You know, I'd get to the liquor store, I would buy the bottle, and as soon as I had the bottle in my hand, it would be like, you know, that feeling. And I'd get home and I'd crack it open, and I would only have two. I had 26-ounce glasses, you know, and I would pour like half a bottle in, you know, with about this much Coke or orange juice or whatever. And I'm telling you, from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock, I would drink that. And I would be completely out of my mind by 6 o'clock. That's a normal day. Now, over the course of time, this started to affect my nervous system. I mean, if you do this, you ever like this in the morning with, you know, loud noises and, you know, like a little bit anxious? I remember going to the doctor and saying, "Doc, I'm like anxious. My heart's pounding. I'm like always nervous. You got anything for that?" And he goes, "Well, I think we do. We got this new drug called Xanax." I go, "Well, what kind of milligrammages you got them things in? Give me the big ones." And so I'm telling you, it would say on this bottle, it would say no alcohol in big, huge, I mean, 5 times the size of any of the other writing on the, no alcohol. So what I would do is I would pour myself a 24-ounce vodka, and I would weigh these things out in my hand. Counting them was ridiculous. I would weigh out about 20 and then drink a quarter. But I'm telling you, there was a six-month period of time I was gone. I was gone. I remember going into work one time, and, you know, the guy who picked me up from work, because I was in between one of my DUIs, you know how that is, he picked me up for work, and he said, "Chris, man, you shouldn't go in. Let me just take you home." I gotta work. You know how we are, right? So he goes, "All right." Now, he lets me out of the truck. Now picture this. It's a big, long parking lot, and then there's the boss's office up there, and the boss is, like, giving orders to all the electricians and sending them out. Now, I walk up there like serpentine. It takes me, like, 15 minutes to walk 100 feet, and I can see my boss looking at me like... He goes, "God damn it! Get him out of here!" You know, and he shamed me. You know how... And sent me home. Now, the thing that really broke the camel's back, though, that forced me to sign myself in, was a small thing. I was sitting on top of a ladder, and I was putting a ground screw into a ceiling fixture box. And you had to put the little screw on the end of the screwdriver. And I'm dropping it. I have to go down and get it. And the guy I was working with was looking at me like, You know how they look at you like that? And you can tell what they're thinking. They're thinking, "You lame, good for nothing, no account, pathetic loser." Because alcoholism allows you that heightened sensitivity to hear people thinking at you. You know what I mean? So, now, I couldn't do it. I couldn't take this anymore. I couldn't feel shame like that. So I got really drunk, and I called up this rehab that I had to go to get my license back for some, you know, multiple DWI. And I said, "I'm coming in." And they're like, "Well, who the hell are you?" You know, figure they were waiting for me. And I got in the next day, and I put myself into 28 days of treatment. Now, you know how alcoholics kind of like reverse brag, or they feel they're better than other people because they're worse or something? Now... Everybody that was in this rehab was in there because of DUIs, or their boss forced them in, or there was an intervention in the family. I was the only guy that signed myself in. So I thought I was better than all of them. You know, I mean, you crashed 5 cars, I crashed 10. You know, we reverse brag. Anyway, so I've got resentments. I'm like a resentment machine at this period of time. Anybody relate to like the early sobriety resentments? Those bastards! You know what I mean? Well, I hated everybody in this rehab. I they're doing it wrong, you know, and why does he get a phone call? There was this one guy named Doug who he was in really bad shape. They had him on Librium for like 3 months. He was just really bad, and he would take up group. You know how they have group? Anybody in here familiar with group in rehab? Where they put you in a circle and everybody talks about their stuff. Well, here's my stuff, and let me talk about my stuff. I want to tell you how I feel. You know, and it goes around the room like, where that came from, you know, Bob Newhart show or something. I have no idea. But it makes no sense to me even today to just let people just talk like that. But anyway, you know, this guy would always just talk, and he would take 45 minutes of the hour, and he would take all, I want to talk, you know? And I had this really bad resentment. And the thing he would share every time is that his wife has got a restraining order, and the whole block is a restraining order around his house, and he can't go home, and he wants to jump in front of a bus. I'm going to jump in front of a bus. I'm going to jump in front of a bus. So this one day, I go down to the nurse's office. I said, listen, I really, this is important. I really need to use the phone. She goes, what for? I go, I've got to order some bus schedules. You know? Mr. Sobriety. I mean, I don't know how we make it through some of these resentments, you know? But anyway, I get out of rehab, and, you know, there's a lot of suggestions. There's a lot of suggestions that you get. And they'll tell you to get a sponsor. They'll tell you to get a home group. They'll tell you to start working the steps with somebody. You know, they'll tell you to get to a lot of meetings, take service commitments, do things to get outside of yourself, come early, stay late, all those suggestions. Now, being a smart person, I outthought them all. I would say, you know, a sponsor, I'm looking around this room, and I'm thinking, you know, this is a, who am I going to pick here? You know, who the hell am I going to pick here? And even if I was going to pick him, what am I going to do? Go up to him and say, hey, listen, you know, my name is Chris. You know, my life is an absolute living hell. I'm living with mom. You know, I got a terrible job. My family doesn't want it. I have restraining orders. I can't do anything. You know, you mind if I, like, drag you down into the hell that's my life on the phone, like, every day, you know, so you know, so that I can unload half of my problems on you. You know, how about, is that okay? You know, I mean, it was like asking a guy to dance or something. It was just, I couldn't do it. So I thought, I'll tell you what, you know, I'll just listen real carefully in the meetings, and that'll be my sponsor. Now, I also said, get a home group. Well, I was going to autonomous meetings that weren't home group meetings. They were just, you know, meetings that popped up that didn't have the integrity of a strong home group. So I'm going to these two meetings, and they're not home groups. So, you know, what can I do? Yeah, and I say, get phone numbers. I don't want to talk. So every single thing that they suggested that was aimed at creating an atmosphere of sobriety until I could find the recovery program, all of those things I short-circuited by being too smart. I would look at the steps on the wall, and I would say, huh, I got real problems, you know? I got real problems. You know, you don't understand. You know, I can see that this might work with some of the scuttlefish, you know? But you're dealing with a tragic case here, you know? Where's the steps with the money and the women, you know? Where's the one about getting a good job? And, you know, I just thought, I don't know, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Now, I was willing to participate. I was going to two meetings a week, and I was paying for, I was going to two outpatients, too, so that's four days a week. What more do you want from me? Prime time TV time, too. 4 days a week. What kind of a commitment? That's a commitment, you know. And I'm paying $85 a night for the outpatient to sit around a group and listen to all these muttonheads talk about their problems. I mean, that is a commitment, right? And I'm telling everybody that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm not drinking. You know, if you're new or just coming back, don't say anything about AA, please. You know, don't give us a black eye, you know? Oh, because what happened with me was I told everybody, my boss, everybody, and here's what happened. I'm on my way to an AA meeting. I have almost 90 days. I'm driving to a meeting, okay? I'm treating my alcoholism. Going to a meeting. And the thought crosses my mind. Now, if you wonder what the obsession of the mind is with step one, this is how I look at it through my own personal experience. I'm on the way to an AA meeting. I've made a commitment across the board to stay sober and go to AA. I'm going to 4 nights a week. I'm going to this AA recovery stuff. The thought crosses my mind, and here's what my mind says. Chris, you know, it's been almost 90 days since you've been drunk. You don't even really remember what it's like to be drunk. And you're not really doing a great job with this AA stuff. You know, if you would buy a gallon of vodka, take it back to the house and drink it, it will make you feel so bad that you will rush back into Alcoholics Anonymous and do everything right. Sounds like a plan. Now, anybody in here sponsor people? You know, how about those plans that you get from some of the newer people? They're beauts. Well, I didn't have a sponsor to run that one by. You know, I'm sure that I would have gotten a little help on that one. But I did it. I bought a gallon of vodka. I went home. Sounds like a good idea. Sounds like a good idea. Sounds like a good idea. All of a sudden, about two-thirds of the way through my third drink, oh, my God, what have I done? You know, I've woken up alcoholism in my body, and I don't know where I'm going to go. I don't know where I'm going to end up. This is horrible. So the insanity that they talk about restoring us to in the second step, that's really what it is. We're insane sober. I had almost 90 days, and the thought crossed my mind to put alcohol in my body. That's the obsession of the mind. And I so wanted to stay separated from alcohol. In an AA meeting, there wouldn't have been anybody that wanted to stay away from booze more than me. I guarantee it. But I had no recovery program. I had no tools. I had nothing in the spiritual bank. So when that thought crossed my mind, I did it. I drank the gallon of vodka, and I was off for about a seven-month relapse that was absolutely horrible. The last part of this seven-month relapse was Christmas at the Schroeders. Okay, my brother and sister were there, nieces and nephews, family animals. Everybody was there. You know, the Christmas tree was decorated, and the stockings were hung by the chimney with care. And all of a sudden, Chris goes into an insane blackout and threatens them all with a .38 caliber handgun. Because I had a resentment. I'm going to kill all of you. You know? Now, this wasn't the festive mood everybody was hoping for, you know? So they packed up their Christmas and they moved it elsewhere. And I come to, and I was shattered. This was a really bad drunk. It was about a 4 or a 5 day drunk, right around Christmas 1989. I've never been in a blackout for that kind of a period of time, but at least 4 days. And I come out of it and I stagger into the kitchen and I'm shattered. That's the only way I can describe it. Just shattered. My mind is ringing. I'm starting to convulse. It was just really DTs. It was really ugly. And I go in the kitchen and there's a pile of vodka bottles about this high in the kitchen. So I don't even remember buying them. And I used to buy one bottle at a time because I might quit. You know that? You know, any smokers in here that buy one pack at a time because you might quit? Same kind of thing. So I must have like serpentined up and down to the middle of town 15 times. What a sight that might have been. But I was at that pitiful and incomprehensibly demoralized state where it's the jumping off point. And I remember saying to God, who I hadn't had a lot of communication with, because when you start doing crimes, you usually have to move God over a little bit, you know, to get him out of the way. You don't want him looking over your shoulder, you know, and writing this stuff down or something. So you kind of ease him out. Now, I remember saying to like the God of my understanding, of my childhood understanding, God, either kill me or let me get sober. I can't live like this anymore. And this is a pretty common experience with alcoholics when you get down that far. And I started detoxing, and I remember animals were running around, and maggots were on the slip covers, things scratching on the house to get in. I remember lying on the couch, all of a sudden a demon came out of the ceiling, one of those big monitor type with a bullhead and the horns, and dripped snot all over me. I was flipping out, and I drink a little bit of water and vomited up, and this is about 3 days worth of detox, and finally, I get off to a meeting. Now, I had to find a flat meeting. Now, what I mean by that is I had a 1976 Ford Granada at this time. You know how we don't fix our cars because we're busy, if we're drinking? Now, it had no clutch. It had no parking brake. It had no muffler. It had no heater core. And this is the middle of winter in New Jersey. If you turn the heater on, it would squirt antifreeze on the inside of the window. The quarter panels were gone. It was a piece of crap. Now, because there was no clutch, I had to find a flat meeting to go to because it would barely run. So I looked in the book, and I found a flat meeting in Morristown. And I remember driving to this. And, Timmy, you'll remember the meeting at the Church of the Redeemer on Sunday night. Well, that was my first meeting coming back. And I remember a whole bunch of people would be standing out having cigarettes on the porch there, and you'd have to drive past them all to get into the parking lot. Now, because this thing had no clutch and it was a little bit of an incline, I had to gun it just to get up. So I'm in this piece of crap, and I go by all my new peers like this. They're all looking, must be a new guy, Didn't have to worry about anybody parking too close to this thing and denting it, I got to tell you. Quite the reverse was opposite. I went into this meeting, and I had that self-centered fear, that awful, awful self-centered fear. And I sat down in the second row, and somebody handed me a step book. Now, I thought this was a beginner's meeting for some reason, right? They hand me a step book, and they go, "We're reading step 12 today." And they open it up to the page for me, and I look down the row, and they're coming down the row, and everybody's reading a paragraph. I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna have to read. I can't even hold the book. So what do? You get up and you leave. Now I'm standing outside, and it was one of those moments where, sometimes fate cuts it so close for us, those coincidences and those things that happen, that if they didn't happen, we wouldn't be here. I was having a cigarette out there on the porch thinking, I can't do this. This is just too much. I'm going to have to, read a paragraph. I'm not going to be able to do this. And this guy, Jorge, comes outside, and he grins me, and he goes, "Hey, what's your deal?" And I said, "I was all relapsed, there's demons, everything, I was vomiting, I was, oh, God, horrible." He goes, Well, why don't you come on back into the meeting? "Well, there's a meeting tomorrow. There's a meeting tomorrow that I think I'll go." Now, he was smart enough to know what tomorrow meant. So he goes, no, come on in. And so, all right, So he drags me in, and we sit down right up there in the second row. And they're done reading the paragraphs by now, thank God. And they're sharing. He leans over to me, and he goes, "Raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back." "Well, what does it mean tomorrow? And tomorrow everybody raises their hand. Everybody says they're coming back." He's like, "Raise your hand." He's starting to get loud now. "Raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back." Now, people are starting to look at me now. And you know what that means. They're going to be thinking at me, too. So I got to do something. So I've never seen this happen before or after. I raise my hand right in the middle of somebody sharing. I just raise my hand. And the leader goes, didn't know what to do, so shut them up and called on me. And I said something really profound, "This is Chris and Alan, all you have to realize that you're crazy, it's your demons, and all the magazines look at you, it's terrible, thank you." And everything's quiet. And all of a sudden, yay! Everybody starts clapping, I came in here tonight thinking I had problems. Oh, thank you, Chris! That is the most pathetic thing I've ever seen in my life. Oh man, you made my day. Now, what happened with this is There was a wall of fear that was going to stop me from coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. I just couldn't deal with it. My level of anxiety was just too high to walk in here with the fluorescent lights and the coffee and everybody smiling and talking about their stuff. I just couldn't do it. Being able to raise my hand and tell people I was coming back pushed a little bit of that wall of fear over. And for the first time in a very, very long time, I thought, you know, I might make it. I might be able to do this thing. So the next night I got a sponsor. I remember going up to him and saying, Phil, I need a sponsor. I've been in hell. I need to get out. Can you help me? And he starts laughing. You know how they are. I could use a new pigeon, he says. Now, I'd never heard that before. You know, it's like sponsee terminology, right? I'm thinking, pigeon? He wants me to be like a rat with wings for him or something. Like, what is this? Okay, you know, I'll be a pigeon. Who do I have to tell on, you know? I had no idea what it meant. But I started to do what he said. He was a fellowship sponsor, and he was a really, really good one. He got me active in service. So he said, Chris, I want you to meeting every night until I tell you to stop. And then he moved away, you know. So like the first 8 years, I went to a meeting every night. And he got me involved in service. He got me involved in doing things for other people without expecting anything back. And that was brutal for me because, you know, we don't know how selfish we are until we get to inventory. And it's like, oh, my God, you know, we realize just how selfish we are. We don't do anything for anybody without expecting something back ever, you know, no matter what we think. And then we realize it by doing inventory, and then our sponsors start to get us to act selfishly. And that breaks that habit of selfishness. And he got me doing rehab commitments and all kinds of stuff. Along the lines, I got hooked in with some people who were really conservative, literature-based, big book people. And I got a chance to go through the steps in a very, very fundamental way. And I learned the difference between sobriety and recovery, okay? Sobriety was that hanging on, just not drinking today. And recovery ended up being so much more than that. It ended up being these promises, the promises that were read. It ends up being it ends up that scared kindergartner that you have inside. All of a sudden, he's free to be whatever and whoever he wants to be, as long as he follows the simple spiritual rules of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't even tell you how great my life is today. I met my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been married 13 years now, 14 years. I went from being a bad electrician to being in just recently being in charge of 80 New York City schools, which is a whole thing in itself. I got to tell you, you want to talk about patience and tolerance. And I was just offered a job now that's a whole career change for me with a group of people that are lobbying for better treatment in the addictive illness field. And so I'm gonna be getting involved in that. You know, we bought a house. I mean, you know, when I would hear people sharing in meetings like, oh, I've got two houses now because I sold one and I can't sell the other, so I'm carrying two mortgages. You're like, who cares? What are you talking? How do you get a house? You know? They're like $4. What do you do to get a house, you know? We're able to buy a house. I have a vehicle constructed during the current period of my sobriety, which that's really something to shoot for if you're new. You know? I'm actually not the last owner of any vehicles now. I used to be the final owner of every vehicle I ever had. I didn't know how to. I had to ask my sponsor how to sell a car. I knew how to turn the title over to the junk man. I didn't know how to sell one. So anyway, like really, things have been doing really great, really, really great. If you're new or you're coming back, here's a truth for you: you have to put enough into Alcoholics Anonymous to get enough back from Alcoholics Anonymous to be able to stay. Okay? We lose people all the time. please get active in this fellowship. Please work a program of recovery with a sponsor or a spiritual advisor that understands the steps. And please be of service. You have no idea how good it'll get. That's all I got. Thanks.